This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
To start us off with our cutting edge innovations, we have Vikram Jaswal, who is professor of psychology at the University of Virginia and editor of the Journal of Cognition and Development. He's a developmental psychologist whose research focuses on communication and social interaction in autism. His work is inspired and informed by the lives and experiences of autistic children and adults and their families. This is just the kind of research we need. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kripke and Dr. Takayama, for the kind invitation and for the introduction. I'm so excited to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit about the work going on in my lab that's focused on how community support and engagement and cognitive science can help non-speaking autistic folks to flourish. I have no financial disclosures relevant to the work I'm going to tell you about today. So as Dr. Kripke mentioned, I am a developmental psychologist. For many years, my research focused on basic questions in typical development, questions about language acquisition, memory development, categorization, social development, and so on. But about, 8 or 10 years ago, I began to transition my research program to focus on communication and social interaction in autistic people. And one of the major inspirations for the research I do has been a community engagement seminar on autism that I taught a few times at the University of Virginia. It's called The Science and Lived Experience of Autism. You can see here pictures of the three cohorts. Each year, a group of 20 undergraduates and about 10 college-age autistic young adults participated in this seminar, where we got to know each other a little bit. We shared a lot of meals and laughs. And the undergraduates and I had the amazing opportunity to learn about autism alongside people who are living it. And down here in the corner, you can see this is Elizabeth Vossler, who was my collaborator in that endeavor and director of Growing Kids Therapy Center. And you'll be hearing from her, I think, in the next presentation. So my experience teaching this seminar really led me to question a lot of the conventional scientific wisdom about autism, and it shaped my research program in a number of ways. So for example, one topic that was repeatedly raised by the autistic students concerned their desire for social connection. And as you might know, one of the oldest, most widely held beliefs about autistic people is that they are not interested in social interaction. And so one line of my research has focused on this erroneous belief. But that's not what I'm going to talk about today. I've told you that our community partners were college-age autistic folks, but what I didn't yet mention is that they are also non-speaking autistic people. I know you've heard from some non-speaking autistic folks already during this conference, but just to remind you, about 30% of autistic people cannot communicate effectively using speech. This includes folks who don't say anything, maybe individuals who talk a bit, but non-speaking people, they can and they do communicate effectively in a lot of ways, like body language or proximity, but they can't communicate effectively using speech. They can't readily share information, thoughts, beliefs, memories, and so on in a conventional language-based way. Well, in addition to not being able to communicate effectively using speech, of course, non-speaking autistic people are autistic. So they act in socially non-normative ways, they move in unusual ways. And so if speaking autistic people are denied access to educational, social, employment, and community opportunities, imagine how difficult things are for the 30% of autistic people who are non-speaking. That's probably around 3 or 4 million people in the US alone. These are the most marginalized of this already marginalized group of people. A quick terminological note, I use non-speaking rather than minimally verbal or non-verbal because non-speaking is the preferred term of the community that I work with. And similarly, I use autistic rather than person with autism because that's the preference of the particular community and group that I work with. So we don't know why. about 30% of autistic people are non-speaking. It's not because they lack the motivation to communicate. I don't think it has to do with cognitive limitations. I think the most likely explanation has to do with the motor challenges that most non-speaking autistic people face, and which involve difficulties in planning and executing intentional movements. So as my colleague Elizabeth Vossler says, speech is the finest of fine motor skills, and the vocal apparatus has to be coordinated perfectly to produce intelligible speech. So traditional approaches that attempt to provide non-speaking autistic people with access to communication are limited in a number of ways. One commonly used approach is called the picture exchange communication system. You can see it here. It involves laminated cards with icons or pictures that can be used for requesting things. So for example, a picture of a cookie could be exchanged for a cookie. The idea is that over several stages of training, the individual would learn to sequence these kinds of icons in order to make comments or ask questions. Unfortunately, however, very few individuals progress beyond the requesting phase. And even if they do, this system is obviously limited in that the vocabulary available to a user is chosen by somebody else. I should mention that PECS-like systems have also been created for tablets and iPads, but they have the same limitations. Verbally based interventions are also common. Here, one underlying assumption seems to be that lack of speech is caused by reduced levels of motivation. Verbally based interventions might use motivating objects to encourage kids to speak. So if the kid wants a cookie, for example, they have to make an approximation to the word cookie. Turns out this is also not effective for most non-speaking folks. In fact, a recent review of the only two randomized control trials focused on communication interventions for non-speaking kids concluded neither intervention resulted in maintained improvements in spoken or nonverbal communication in most children. So most non-speaking autistic children and adults are never provided access to an effective form of language-based communication, despite undergoing years or decades of interventions like those I've just described. Maybe this goes without saying, but I'll just make it explicit. Being able to express yourself is so essential to well-being that it is considered by the United Nations, for example, to be a fundamental human right, right up there with the right not to be tortured. So providing access to communication is a social justice issue. It's a human rights issue. So I said that a group of non-speaking autistic students participated in this university seminar that I was teaching and that we discussed autism, among other things. So how did these discussions take place? Well, these folks communicate in writing. So like one of the presenters that you heard from earlier in the conference, these individuals have learned over the course of many years and guided by parents and professionals to point to letters on a letterboard held vertically by a trained assistant. This allows them to spell out their thoughts and ideas. So before going any further, I want to make three important points. First, this is a method that developed in practice, not from research. And so some of what we end up doing in the lab is kind of reverse engineering the method, trying to understand why it's effective and who it's effective for. The second important point is that this is not a skill that these individuals learned overnight. And the third point is that all the people I know who communicate in this way, they're working on the skills to be able to type independently without assistance. That's their goal. But right now, their most effective means of communication involves the assistance of another person. So I know you've already seen an example, but let me show you another. So in this video, this is a 22-year-old who began to learn to use the letterboard about 6 years before this video was taken. So she's wearing a camera that allows us to see things from her perspective. I'll say more about that later. At the time, she had really limited ability to use speech. If you met her and you said hello and introduced yourself, she might respond with a stock greeting and her own name, but she would certainly not have been able to use speech to respond to a question like the one you'll see here, which is, have you ever experienced uncertainty? The other thing you should know is that even though she can't use speech effectively to convey her thoughts, She's reached a point in her practice of this communication method where she calls out letters even before she touches them. And sometimes she'll say a word after she's pointed to all the letters in that word. So she was asked in the course of a conversation whether she'd ever experienced uncertainty.
Have you ever experienced uncertainty?
E-R-V-E-R-Y, very, O-N-E, everyone, D-O-E-S-I-M-N-O-D-I.
Keep going, D-I.
F-F-E-R-E-N-T, different.
So she spells, everyone does, I'm no different. By the way, this person graduated from college with a degree in biology in 2022. And so, as I said, it was folks like these who've learned to communicate in this way by pointing to letters on a letter board held vertically by a trained assistant who participated in this community engagement seminar that I taught. They shared their perspectives and lived experiences with me and the undergraduates in a way that would not have been possible if they'd been relying on picture communication system or their very limited ability to speak. So I want to show you a short video to illustrate the kind of inclusive educational experience that we tried to create.
I'm Vikram Jaswal. I'm an associate professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. For the past 3 years, I've been teaching this two-semester seminar called The Science and Lived Experience of Autism. We try to explore the tension between what the science says about autism and what the lived experience of autism is like.
We work as a class of about 16 students with a partner cohort of non-speaking autistic individuals.
They don't use spoken language reliably or in some cases at all. And something that happens as these guys are spelling out their responses is that the non-autistic participants, we all learn to slow down.
What we do is we come prepared with a reading or maybe a video clip that we've all watched, and then we spend the entire day kind of digging into what we got out of it, both from a neurotypical perspective and an autistic perspective. They basically showed that there was no significant eye fixation difference between the two groups, which is a very surprising finding.
A, C, T, I find the obsession with eye contact, and G, to be annoying, M, A, L. I believe it is about NTs wanting us to look normal.
One of the goals is to get students to think about, what do you do when the science doesn't match the lived experience?
It's a really wide misconception that if you're not displaying interest in a neurotypical way, if you're not, for instance, making eye contact, or you're not verbalizing something that you want to verbalize, you're just not interested in engaging.
But when you actually talk to these guys and you spend time with them, you find that for many of them, nothing could be further from the truth. They're longing for social connection, they want to make friends, but their bodies just aren't able to cooperate in a way that allows them to do it.
I think the most shocking thing continues to be how wrong I was about what it looks like to be listening and what it looks like to be interested.
For the most part, the educational experience of autistic folks is one of separation from their typically developing peers. And I see our seminar as an example of how we can create an inclusive educational environment. Part of what has to happen is for society to make accommodations, for the neurotypical folks to learn ways to support autistic people as they are.
If we come in with a baseline of, let's just see what this person can do, trust their capabilities, trust their interest, then I think we create way more inclusive spaces because we don't bring in all of these preconceived notions about what someone can and can't do.
Well, after that big buildup I gave you about most non-speaking autistic people never gaining access to communication and being deprived of educational and social opportunities that many people take for granted, I hope you're thinking, well, that's awesome. These folks have access to a method of communication that's clearly effective for them, allowing them to flourish and participate in a way that they would not otherwise be able to participate. You probably also have a lot of questions. You might be wondering about the training process, who the method might be effective for, how these folks could best be supported in their goal to transition to typing on a keyboard. You probably also have questions about what role the assistant plays in the process in terms of the attentional, regulatory, and emotional support they provide. These are exactly the kinds of questions that we're interested in studying in my lab also. But we've also had to address an elephant in the room. As you might know, there are critics who insist that non-speaking people who communicate with assistants, people like those who participated in my seminar, could not possibly be conveying their own thoughts. They think that the assistant is somehow cueing the user to point to particular letters. I think part of this criticism stems from a disbelief that a non-speaking autistic person could have sophisticated thoughts, like everybody experiences uncertainty, I'm no different. I think it also suggests that the critics haven't had much time to spend with non-speaking autistic people who spell. Unfortunately, the critics have succeeded in preventing non-speaking autistic people from having access to this and related methods of communication in schools and other settings. The non-speaking autistic folks that I know who spell, including those who participated in my seminars over the years, are absolutely aware of these critics. And having their communicative agency questioned takes an incredible toll on them. Many have been denied access to their most effective means of communication, without which they cannot, for example, participate in school or access the kinds of educational opportunities they'd like. So inspired by these lived experiences of non-speaking folks and in collaboration with them and other members of the community, we've embarked on several projects over the past few years where we apply the tools of cognitive science to questions about communication in non-speaking people. Today, I'll tell you briefly about three lines of work. The details are available from the published papers, which are available at my lab's website, and also put some QR codes up, which you can also get the papers from. So I'll tell you about first some work investigating this question of communicative agency among those who are learning to communicate by spelling. A second line of work that addresses questions about literacy with this population. And a third line of work that asks about how we might leverage advances in technology to provide some folks with personalized communication interfaces. So in our first study, we set out to see how plausible the critics' objections to methods of communication like the ones you've seen were. Are users somehow being directed to each letter they point to? This is work done in collaboration with Allison Wayne, who was an undergraduate at the time, and Hudson Galeno, who's a quantitative psychologist in my department. We recruited a group of non-speaking autistic young adults who communicate in this way, fitted them with eye tracking glasses like you see here, that would allow us to record what they looked at and pointed to. And we asked them to spell responses to a bunch of questions they'd never heard before, like the one you heard earlier, have you ever experienced uncertainty? Now we know from over a century of research in psychology that responding to a cue takes time and is subject to error. So to take a simple example, imagine that we're having dinner and I'm trying to give you a subtle cue to check out the shoes at somebody at the next table. So it would take time for me to produce that cue. It would take time for you to detect it and interpret it. And at least in my family, there would be a lot of confusion and error. So if participants spelled slowly, or if they made a lot of mistakes, cueing might be a plausible explanation for their performance. In fact, we found that spellers' accuracy and speed profile makes cueing by the assistant an unlikely explanation for their performance. Spellers rarely misspelled a word, and as you saw in that clip I showed you earlier, they spelled at a pretty fast rate, touching about one letter each second on average. We also know from decades of research in cognitive science that people tend to look at things before they touch them. Why? Because you're going to be much more accurate at adjusting your movements toward your intended goal, toward the target, if you make use of visual feedback. So we asked whether users looked at letters before touching them. If they do, we can say that they're not just holding out their finger and waiting for the assistant to move the board underneath it, but they're actively or agentically seeking out letters that they will point to themselves. Let me show you an example of what this looks like. This participant is a man who was 26 at the time the video was taken. In this video, I've overlaid the eye tracking information, which is represented by this red dot you can see down here. On this particular frame, you can see that the user is both looking at the letter W, you can see that from the red dot, and pointing to the letter W. So to be clear, nobody sees this red dot during the session. It's only visible in the video that's produced after the session has ended, and it's what we use in order to do our analyses. So what I want you to note in this video is how clearly that red dot, which represents where the user is looking, precedes his point to each letter. In the course of a conversation about waiting, this participant was asked to name something that he had to wait for.
W-A-I-T-I-N-G, waiting, F-L-R for M, Y, my, D, R, E, A, M, G, I, R, L. Waiting for my dream girl.
Waiting for my dream girl. So that clip, I think, illustrated pretty clearly that spellers look at letters before touching them. And our analyses show that they do so about half a second before touching them. So together, the accuracy, timing, and visual fixation data that we collected are consistent with what you'd expect if participants were communicating their own thoughts. They're not consistent with the cueing explanation that critics have put forward. I have to be clear here that I'm not suggesting that everybody will be able to learn to use a letter board to communicate effectively. Different people are going to benefit from different kinds of support. But our data clearly show that the blanket dismissal of communication that involves the assistance of another person is unwarranted. Okay, I'm going to turn now to the second line of work that I'll describe today. This is a study that was just published investigating literacy in non-speaking autistic people. This was done in collaboration with two graduate students I work with, Andrew Lampe, who graduated in May, and Caden Stockwell. In this study, we asked whether some non-speaking autistic teens and adults have learned to spell. You might ask, doesn't the fact that there are folks who communicate by spelling already show that some have learned to spell? Yes, but it's important to have converging evidence from multiple methods, particularly given the charged atmosphere around methods of communication that involve the assistance of another person. So we developed a method to investigate one important aspect of literacy, namely whether non-speaking autistic people could convert the sounds of language, that's called phonology, into their written form, orthography. For someone who can speak, you can just ask them to spell words and assess their abilities explicitly. But because our interest is in folks who can't speak and for whom there may be other performance-related reasons that they can't demonstrate their abilities explicitly, we designed a task that could assess their abilities indirectly. Using indirect tasks is ubiquitous in cognitive science. Indirect tasks allow developmental psychologists to ask questions about infants' understanding of the world, cognitive psychologists to develop models of information processing, social psychologists to document the existence of implicit biases, and so on. And so the logic is that you might present participants with two tasks that differ in just one dimension, and then measure how long it takes them to complete each task. If they're faster on one task than the other, it suggests that participants were processing information in the two tasks differently. So our method was inspired by the whack-a-mole arcade game that was popular in the 1980s and 90s. Remember that game where you were just supposed to whack each mole with a mallet as it popped out of its hole? To my knowledge, the moles popped out in random locations, but imagine how much faster you would be if you knew in advance the sequence in which the moles were going to pop out. This is what we attempted to exploit in the study I'll tell you about. Participants in our study saw letters of the alphabet displayed on an iPad, like you see here, and they're simply to tap whatever letter they saw pulsing as quickly as they could. Now, on some trials, participants were told the sequence in which the letters would pulse, as in this example, I should water the backyard today. Because they'd heard the sequence ahead of time, if participants could spell, they could anticipate where the next pulsing letter would be. Each participant would see five sequences of sentences like this one. So we compared how quickly they responded to pulsing letters in this letter board condition with a condition where the same participants responded to five sequences of pulsing nonsense symbols. So here the targets pulsed in the same locations and same sequence as in the letter condition. But because the targets were nonsense symbols, regardless of whether participants could spell, they wouldn't be able to predict where the next pulsing symbol would be. So our question was whether participants would be faster to tap pulsing targets in the letter condition, where they could predict the sequence if they knew how to spell, compared to the closely matched symbol condition, where they couldn't predict the sequence. We conducted this study with 31 non-speaking autistic teens and adults. Now, our participants had experience learning to use the letter board, but I want to emphasize that this study was conducted entirely on an iPad secured on a stand in front of participants. No one held the iPad or touched them. The task was simply to respond as quickly as possible to each flashing target. So, to our question, were participants faster in the letter condition than the symbol condition? Indeed, they were. You can see in this figure, the average time between taps was shorter in the letter board condition, represented by this function, compared to the symbol board condition. And remember, the only difference between these two conditions is that in the case of the letter board condition, participants who knew how to spell could anticipate the next letter in the sequence in a way that simply wasn't possible in the symbol board interface. Okay, so these data, along with some other kinds of analyses that I didn't have time to present here, suggest that most participants in our study have acquired an important aspect of literacy, the ability to convert the sounds of language into their written form. Of course, we don't know from this study how participants acquired this skill. It might be that learning to communicate by pointing to letters, which all participants in our study had experience doing, that perhaps was part of the process. That's the subject of a future study. Okay, so I'll turn now to the third and final part of my talk. So far, my focus has been on documenting skills that folks who communicate with assistants currently have. In this last part of the talk, I'll tell you about some work that we're doing to try to understand how we can leverage technology to support communication in non-speaking autistic people. This is a project done in collaboration with Divakar Krishnamurthy at the University of Calgary in electrical engineering and a team of his students, along with folks in my lab. So let me begin just by telling you what augmented reality is. Augmented reality is a way to make it seem like virtual objects are part of a user's actual space. So if you were wearing a device in your kitchen, you could place a hologram of a vase with flowers on your actual counter and see your actual refrigerator and your actual stove. So it differs from virtual reality in that it's less immersive. Well, there's a certain wow factor to augmented reality. These are some demos from Microsoft. You can see it's like cool to interact with the Death Star, for example, but it can also be used for educational content. Like here, you can see someone interacting with the elements of the periodic table. So why would we be interested in using AR with non-speaking autistic folks? I can think of a bunch of reasons. First, why shouldn't non-speaking autistic people have access to the same kinds of cool technology that everybody else has access to? But there are also some aspects of AR that could make it a really attractive learning tool for this population. So for example, material can be presented in really customized ways in terms of size and color and so forth. The holograms can be made to stay in front of a user as they move around. And as you might know, a lot of non-speaking autistic folks are in constant motion. Game-like modules could be developed to practice particular skills, including those that might lead up to typing. And then there's the potential to actually create interfaces that could be used for communicating in this environment. But our first step in this project was straightforward, and that was to investigate whether non-speaking autistic people could tolerate wearing the device. It weighs over a pound, and as you might know, a lot of non-speaking autistic folks have some sensory sensitivities. And we also asked whether they could learn to interact with the holograms. So with the collaboration of non-speaking people and their families and clinicians, we developed a protocol to introduce users to the HoloLens and to a game that involved pushing holographic buttons to see an animation of a fox. So there were three rounds in this game that became increasingly difficult. The buttons got smaller and subjects were required to push buttons before a countdown timer ran out. We tested a group of 17 non-speaking autistic young adults on this sort of proof of concept study. Our first question was whether non-speaking people could tolerate the device. The answer was yes. 88% wore the device long enough to start the game. The next question was whether non-speaking autistic people could learn to push holographic buttons. The answer here was also yes. Everybody who started the game completed at least two rounds, and most of them completed all three rounds in the game. Furthermore, subjects got faster on subsequent rounds, meaning that they easily learned what was required to activate the holographic buttons in one round and transferred that knowledge to the next round. We think our findings open up exciting and new possibilities for the design of software for non-speaking autistic people, including AR software that could be used to build the skills that underlie alternative forms of communication like typing. Let me just give you a teaser of a couple of things we've been working on in this space. This is work led by Laurence Alaboud, who's a postdoc in Dr. Krishnamurthy's lab. One question is whether it would be possible to design a system that would allow for remote instruction in communication. And here's just a quick example. Here, two individuals are each wearing the device. They're interacting in the same virtual environment with the same virtual letterboard. So in this particular case, let's say the image on the left comes from a user and the image on the right comes from a practitioner who's teaching the skills to make use of spelling as a means of communication. In this particular example, they're in the same physical space, but they in principle could be anywhere in the world apart from each other. Here's another example. This is work that's hot off the press. Laurence just completed a study with spellers who are skilled on the physical letterboard to investigate whether they could transition to using a virtual letterboard independently. And indeed, after a short, on the order of 10 minutes training procedure, most participants could spell short words on the virtual letterboard independently. And some, as you can see here on the right, actually went on to offer some feedback about the system. I think this person was spelling out, it was interesting. So as I said, this opens up, we think, all kinds of exciting possibilities. On the practical side, machine learning could be used to figure out the optimal placement of a communication interface. We could use it to enable predictive text. We could automate some of the prompting that the human assistant would otherwise provide, and so on. And then stepping back, I think this has the potential to also make possible private conversations, communication that doesn't require an intermediary. So between friends or between an individual and a healthcare provider, for example. The long-term goal of this kind of work is the creation of personalized interfaces that make communication as effortless as speaking is for most people. So I've told you about three projects about communication that we've been working on in collaboration with non-speaking autistic people. As we learn more about autism, particularly from autistic people themselves, we're also learning how little we understand about it and that many of our assumptions about autistic people are wrong. And these assumptions, they're not just wrong, but they have prevented the kinds of flourishing that everybody would like to see. So I want to thank the non-speaking folks I've had the privilege of getting to know for helping to move autism science in a more useful, progressive, data-driven direction. And also to thank the participants in the studies I've described for their enthusiastic participation. Thanks also to the funders of this work, including the Akil Autism Foundation and the SSHRC in Canada, and all the research assistants in my lab and collaborators at Calgary. And thank you for your attention. So the published papers I talked about today are available at my lab's website. And I guess I'll stop there, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And of course, to continue a conversation offline via email as well. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you. There's lots of questions here. I'll try to get it through as many as I can. Sure. One question is, could predictive words in a computer work?
Yeah, great question. I think that's certainly in the augmented reality interfaces that we're designing. That's one of the features that we're hoping to enable. And some existing AAC devices, augmentative and alternative communication devices, make use of predictive text just in the same way that a lot of us make use of it for texting and so on. So that's certainly a feature that could be useful for some people.
Another question is, the letterboard seems to be alphabetical and computer keyboards are QWERTY. Would a letterboard using a QWERTY keyboard be more applicable? And what about written languages that don't use the alphabet, like complex Chinese characters?
Oh, excellent questions. You're absolutely right. So as I mentioned, the particular system that I've been working and studying with, that was developed in practice rather than in research. And so I don't have the answer to why it was done in alphabetical order. I could make some guesses. One might be that the order A through Z is maybe a little bit more intuitive for somebody who's just learning to begin to spell than the QWERTY order of the letters. But of course, that doesn't have to be the case. The sequence of the alphabet is arbitrary. A through Z seems intuitive to those of us who have a lot of experience with it, but it is completely arbitrary. So in principle, it might be possible to start with a QWERTY organization instead, but that's just not what has been done with a group of folks that I work with. And then the Chinese character one is very interesting. I don't have enough experience with folks who are communicating in other languages to know, but I know, for example, that there's an excellent book called The Reason I Jump, which was written by Naoki Higashida. And he made use of many different kinds of letterboard-like interfaces. He's a Japanese kid, well, now adult.
There's a question about what you think about music therapy interventions.
Yeah, this is not something that I've studied, but I think a lot of the non-speaking autistic folks, a lot of autistic folks and a lot of non-autistic folks really enjoy music. And so I think that there's a potential that could be a really effective way for people to develop connection with each other. If you both are enjoying music together, that's a way to show that you're sharing some similar kinds of experiences. And that could be helpful to generate opportunities for communication.
There's people asking for your email address if you want to put it if you want to make it available.
Sure. It's just my last name, jazzwall@virginia.edu.
Let's see. What can we say to critics of facilitated communication that impact funding of the assistant?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that I mentioned. I think a lot of assumptions and erroneous beliefs about methods of communication that involve the assistance of another person, these assumptions and incorrect beliefs have prevented a lot of people from gaining access to methods of communication that might be effective for them. So, I mean, part of the charge of the research program that I've embarked upon is to, you know, provide as much data as we can to demonstrate that this blanket dismissal of these kinds of methods of communication just isn't warranted. They can be the most effective way for some people to communicate. And as I mentioned also, all the folks I know who communicate in alternative ways that involve the assistance of another person, they're working on the skills to be able to type independently. And some of them have achieved that. So, it's a very challenging situation, but hopefully with data, we'll be able to make some progress.
Thank you. And one more question. Ideally, should the letterboard technique be started at a very young age?
Well, I'm not a practitioner. The folks that I know who use this as a method of communication, they've started at lots of different ages, and they have many of them are fluent even as they began learning it at, 20 or 40 even. So I don't think there's any window that's going to close. I think there's the literacy study, for example, that we conducted suggests that even though a lot of folks may not have been given the opportunity for formal literacy training, much of which involves speech, right? Sounding out words and so on, which non-speaking people are not going to be able to do. Even though these folks may not have had formal literacy training, many of them have picked up on a lot of the orthographic or spelling conventions that are present in English, at least. So I think that it's never too early to start providing people access to as many different ways of communicating as possible. But I don't think that there's like a critical period beyond which it's not going to be possible for somebody to learn how to communicate if given the right support and tools.
That's super important. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.